Welcome to Managing AML. I'm Keith Pretz. In today's presentation, I'll be reviewing the diagnosis and prognosis of acute myeloid leukemia, or AML. I hope to improve your comprehension of real-world issues associated with diagnosis and increase awareness of diagnostic criteria and prognostic factors under investigation. In this video, I will provide you with the information and tools necessary to identify patients suspected of AML, and summarize diagnostic testing strategies that should be implemented, understand revisions to the World Health Organization's criteria for diagnosing and prognosticating AML and their impact on clinical practice. So let's begin. Acute myeloid leukemia in 2017 in the United States occurs in approximately 21,000 adult patients. And of those, approximately 10,000 will die each year. The median age of patients with acute myeloid leukemia is 70 years old. And as you can see, the incidence in over age 65 patients is quite high, with approximately 20 cases per 100,000 individuals. So your chance of developing acute myeloid leukemia in a 50-year-old is 1 in 50,000. Whereas a 70-year-old, it's much higher, 1 in 5,000. To suspect the diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia is when there's presence of circulating blasts in the white blood cell differential, when you may see cytopenias in a patient with prior chemotherapy or radiation therapy, when there are cytopenias seen in anyone over age 60, there should be a suspicion of a bone marrow problem. Likewise, in a younger adult, patients who present with out of the blue bruising, bleeding, or otherwise atypical infections consideration should be given for the diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia. The diagnostic approach to a patient who has a suspicion of acute myeloid leukemia is first done with reviewing the complete blood count and differential. Often thereafter, a blood smear will be done to look for the presence of blasts, and in those cases where it's readily identified, patients should then proceed to a bone marrow biopsy with aspirate. There are several important features of the bone marrow biopsy which are critical for the diagnosis. The first would be the core biopsy itself, which will give you the a relative percentage of cells that have blast-like features. We always get an aspirate and a bone marrow differential, which also quantifies the number of atypical cells in the bone marrow. Flow cytometry is the current state-of-the-art way of making the diagnosis of myeloid leukemia versus lymphoid leukemia. And it also can allow us to prognosticate in certain situations. Beyond that, the genetics of the leukemia are critical to establish not only the appropriate treatment, but the risks and response likelihood of a patient undergoing treatments. So there are FISH studies looking for specific translocations and deletions associated with the leukemia. There are enlarging numbers of molecular studies now that are critical in the diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia. The ones that are listed on this slide, mutations in the receptor tyrosine kinase FLT3, represent approximately 30% of patients with acute myeloid leukemia, and there are several therapeutic strategies to take advantage of this mutation, which may confer some improvement in survival, so that's a critical feature to know at the time of diagnosis. Others include mutations in nucleophosmin gene, or NPM1. These occur in approximately 40% of adults with acute myeloid leukemia and can markedly change the risk of a patient going through treatment and the likelihood of ultimately relapsing or not. The other gene that's clearly associated with a favorable outcome are mutations in CEBP-alpha. And we'll talk a little bit later about some nuance about those mutations, but these clearly do represent an important diagnostic subtype of leukemia, which probably has a very favorable outcome. Other mutations include point mutations in genes such as IDH, c-KIT, JAK2, and p53 are being picked up in the molecular genetics assessments of leukemias now, and several companies now are doing a large number of mutational screening analysis of leukemics at the time of diagnosis, and some of these genes do represent therapeutic targets, so it may become more and more important to know the status of the leukemia mutations associated at the time of diagnosis. Of note, diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia is something you can obtain on a core biopsy, but if no aspirate is obtained, genetic analysis is very difficult to do. In patients who have significant circulating leukemia, those with greater than 20% blasts, most of these genetic tests can be done on peripheral blood. We still favor the bone marrow aspirate as the primary source for the genetic testing. Beyond the bone marrow biopsy, you should be looking towards the chemistries such as uric acid and phosphorus to determine whether a patient is undergoing tumor lysis at the time of diagnosis. These things are treatable and are important to keep in a good range at the time you do institute therapy. Other things include looking at coagulation cascade members to look for DIC. It's not uncommon for acute myeloid leukemia to present in certain circumstances with disseminated intravascular coagulation, and that can be associated with not only bleeding but clotting disorders and patients with fibrinogens under 100 will often replace it with cryoprecipitate. As I mentioned earlier, not only can the genetics be done on peripheral blood, but flow cytometry often can be done on peripheral blood, but the diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia can only be made in patients who have 20% or greater blasts either in the bone marrow or blood in most circumstances. Imaging is not a routine requirement at the time of diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia, but in patients who do have neurologic symptoms, CT imaging of the brain at the time of diagnosis to assess for hemorrhage is important because in the event that there is hemorrhage identified, the goal thresholds for replacement of platelets and other blood products certainly change. Patients sometimes come in with confusion and there's suspicion of involvement of the brain itself with the leukemia, and in those circumstances, MRI of the brain with contrast can help determine evidence of that. And lastly, imaging of the heart prior to any chemotherapy is important to document normal ejection fraction and allow for the appropriate dosing of anthracycline in those cases. Lastly, patients with acute myeloid leukemia can have seeding into the spinal fluid. It's more common in patients with presentations with a high white blood cell count. It's more common in patients with monocytic acute myeloid leukemia. It's more common in patients with inversion 16 and translocation 821 acute myeloid leukemia. And it's more common in patients who have extramedullary disease or granulocytic sarcoma at the time of diagnosis. And in all these circumstances, we do recommend patients undergo lumbar puncture with intrathecal cytarabine to screen for involvement of CNS leukemia and treat any disease that might be present. As I mentioned before, the diagnostic requirements for acute myeloid leukemia in most cases require greater than 20% blasts in the blood or bone marrow sampling. There are at least two exceptions. Those are the genetic the defined subtypes, which include translocations of chromosome 8 and 21 and inversion 16 leukemias, those diagnoses can be made in the presence of fewer than 20% blasts and do occasionally get picked up this way. Those leukemias are treated as a standard AML even when they do have less than 20% blasts. There is one change to the WHO criteria with the revisions in 2016, which I'll briefly mention here. In previous iterations of the WHO criteria, pure erythroid leukemia had two subtypes, one of which required assessment of the erythroid component of the bone marrow. The current revision removes that requirement and aligns it with the other diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemias, which require 20% myeloblasts in the bone marrow. So now that we've defined patients who have the diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia, in particular, a large fraction of these patients are over age 65, the question will arise, are they treatable, and are they treatable with intense chemotherapy? And at the time of diagnosis, there are a few factors that influence the likelihood of safety with treatment of with intense therapies, and those involve the age of the patient at the time of diagnosis and the performance status at the time of diagnosis. In the over age 75 group of patients, those with performance status is even at PS at level 2 or ECOG performance level 2, the 30-day mortality with induction chemotherapy is approximately 50%. So these are quite difficult to treat older patients, and even in the age 60 to 75 range, performance status 2 patients have a 30-day mortality of 30% or more. So alternative strategies are becoming more and more common in that age group that we define as high risk for induction mortality. Induction is typically a combination of chemotherapy with cytarabine and an anthracycline. We refer to it as 7 plus 3 or traditional chemotherapy induction. Standard cytarabine dosing is either 100 or 200 milligrams per meter squared per day as a continuous infusion for 7 days. And the anthracycline dosing is a range of doses, but commonly given as 60 milligrams per meter squared of daunorubicin as an IV push day 1, 2, and 3 of treatment. Once this therapy is in, on day 14 of the treatment, a bone marrow aspirate will be obtained looking for aplasia. In those cases where there are fewer than 5% cells in the bone marrow, we write for recovery. If we see a significant amount of residual leukemia, patients will often be given 5 more days of cytarabine and 2 more doses of anthracycline, and then we will wait for recovery at that point. In the typical under age 60 group of patients, the complete remission rates are approximately 75%. That includes patients who require a second course of chemotherapy. But this is not the case in all adults, and ultimately the over age 60 group and the patients with more complicated genetics do worse over time. Other features that influence prognosis of acute myeloid leukemia include patients with a high white blood cell count at presentation. That's often associated with genetic changes in FLT3 gene. Patients who have central nervous system involvement or extramedullary disease at presentation often have a worse prognosis overall. Age at time of presentation is clearly a predictor of outcomes, and as older patients typically present with more complicated genetics and in less frequent good risk leukemias. Prior therapy with chemotherapy or radiation therapy is associated with an inferior outcome. patients who have an antecedent hematologic disorder, such as patients who present with acute myeloid leukemia after polycythemia vera or other myeloproliferative disorders, or myelodysplastic syndrome, clearly have an inferior outcome. And then there are fairly uncommon but well-described predisposition syndromes, such as Li-Fermani syndrome, which is a heritable mutation in P53 gene, clearly have a more difficult time with curing those leukemias with chemotherapy alone. And then going back in to the older classification system, there's an FAB classification system that's still reflected in the WHO criteria, but some of the more differentiated leukemias, such as erythroid leukemias, megakaryocytic leukemias, tend to do quite poorly with chemotherapy alone. The current state of the art for risk stratification for acute myeloid leukemia is described in this slide. Favorable risk leukemias are only associated with specific karyotypic abnormalities in, with inversion 16 or translocation 16-16 and translocation 8-21 representing the most common favorable cytogenetic abnormalities in acute myeloid leukemia. Translocation 15-17 is the pathognomonic translocation associated with acute promyelocytic leukemia, and I will not be discussing that today as it's typically treated in a much different manner. But beyond the cytogenetics, now we're defining patients with normal karyotypes with specific mutations that are conferring favorable risks. And the most common one being patients who present with a normal karyotype, an NPM1 mutation in the absence of a FLT3-ITD mutation. Those patients do reasonably well with standard chemotherapy and consolidation, and we would not deem them as high risk at the time of diagnosis. The other molecular subtype that seems to confer a favorable risk are those patients who have what we call a biallelic or double mutation in the gene CEBP-alpha. And this, somewhat uncommon, but seems to be associated with a quite favorable outcome in patients treated with standard chemotherapy followed by consolidation. Intermediate risk acute myeloid leukemia is associated with generally normal karyotype, but there are a few translocations and additions that are associated with this risk category. And patients who present with translocation 821 or inversion 16 who have also been found to have a c-kit mutation fall into this intermediate risk category. And virtually everything beyond that we would define as poor risk. Those include patients with complex karyotypic abnormalities, patients with monosomies in chromosome 5, chromosome 7, patients with translocations 11 not involving the ninth chromosome. Those typically have a poor outcome. And then others, including inversion 3 and blast crisis CML, tend to have a poor risk with standard chemotherapy. And then in the molecular abnormalities category, in patients who present with normal karyotypes, those who present with a FLT3-ITD mutation are poor risk, and those who are found to have a P53 mutation are also difficult to cure with chemotherapy alone. More recent parsing of the molecular abnormalities data by groups in Europe have started to try to parse out some of the intermediate patients to better define their outcomes. And in one commonly used risk stratification system through the European Leukemia Net group, there are two subtypes of intermediate, one of which involves patients with various degrees of FLT3 mutations patients without FLT3 mutations and without an NPM1 mutation also fall into this intermediate classification. And as you can see in this slide set, the favorable risk patients in the ELN risk stratification system with chemotherapy alone have a 5-year disease-free survival of greater than 60%, whereas those with an adverse prognostic features have a 5-year survival of 10% or less. And the intermediate classifications fall in between. One should note the intermediate two patients do somewhat better than the intermediate one patients in this risk stratification system, which is somewhat counterintuitive, but looking closely at the colors of these figures, you'll pick that up. So molecular diagnostics in the year 2017 are critically important for risk prognostication. Likewise, they can be used to identify specific targeted therapies, and there are several in development for targeting FLT3 mutations, targeting IDH mutations, targeting patients with mutated or deleted P53 genes, and others, including BCL2 targeted agents, would seem to be quite active in the IDH mutation group of patients. But basing the therapeutic decisions on the genetics can only be done when you have a quality sample of the tumor, and this is best found in the bone marrow. And it's quite important to understand what you're assessing with the molecular tests, as the molecular diagnostics are only able to identify these mutations when there's a significant amount of tumor in the sample sent. Unfortunately, many of these tests cannot be routinely added to biopsy material post-biopsy, so it's important to ask for these tests to be done at the time of diagnosis. And as I mentioned earlier, most of the commercial lab services and referral services do have some kind of multi-gene leukemia panel now. And it's not a consensus guideline, but it is becoming more and more common to have these multi-gene panels done to look for not only prognostic information, but the potential therapeutic information. And as these panels include more and more genes, the costs for the panel are becoming less than asking for the individual genes themselves. Reflected in this slide are the changes to the World Health Organization criteria for acute myeloid leukemia in 2016. I'm pointing out here those revisions which include specific subtyping based on recurrent genetic abnormalities, and at least two of these rely only on the molecular testing, including those with an NPM1 mutation and those with biallelic mutations of CEBP-alpha. There's been more description of therapy-related myeloid neoplasms currently, and one should note that therapy-related myeloid neoplasm does not require greater than 20% blast to land in this criteria. It only has to be associated with patients who have received cytotoxic chemotherapy or therapeutic radiation prior to the development of their myeloid neoplasm. As I mentioned earlier, the pure erythroid leukemia diagnostic criteria has changed in this revision, and there are two revisions to the myeloid proliferations associated with Down syndrome, which is somewhat uncommon in adults, but occasionally picked up in the younger adult group. So briefly, I'm going to walk through some of the prognostic information gained from two specific genetic mutations. In this slide, we're reviewing what is the outcomes of patients with mutations in CEBP-alpha. And the overall survival in patients with double mutant CEBP-alpha treated with standard induction chemotherapy is approximately 70 percent in this group of patients at 5 years. Single mutant patients still do better than those with no mutations in CBP-alpha, but it's not quite as good as those with double mutations. And beyond that, there are ways to parse out more than just the influence of CBP-alpha on the outcomes. And figure B and C here overlook those patients with single mutant CBP-alphas and how that influences outcomes with or without NPM1 or with or without FLT3 mutations. Patients who have FLT3 ITD mutations have various degrees of responses to therapy and relapse. Those relapse likelihoods are influenced by other mutations found in the leukemic clone. And this slide reviews patients with FLT3 ITD mutations with or without NPM1 mutations. And as you can see, patients with a FLT3 ITD without a NPM1 mutation have approximately a 30% disease-free survival at 3 years, whereas those patients with a NPM1 mutation have a 40 to 50% survival at that time. This slide reviews the outcomes of patients with cytogenetically normal acute myeloid leukemia with mutations in IDH1 and IDH2. IDH1 and IDH2 mutations collectively are found in approximately 15% of patients with acute myeloid leukemia. Individually, they're found in 7 to 10% of cases. The overall survival in patients with either IDH1 or IDH2 mutant AML tend to be worse than those without those mutations. And reflected in this slide are the impact of NPM1 mutation found in patients with IDH1 or IDH2 mutations. One should note that patients with IDH1 mutations without a NPM1 mutation do quite poorly. Those patients often are recommended to pursue something beyond chemotherapy to improve their outcomes over time. The key points that we should take from this discussion are the management of acute myeloid leukemia in 2017 is more complicated than just finding 20% blasts. Genetics beyond chromosomes are now an important feature for subtype classification and prognostication. And most prognostic systems use FLT3, NPM1, and CBP-alpha to risk adjust. Thank you for viewing this activity.